Once again, we want to extend to you our welcome. And in particular, if you're somebody who is a visitor here, we certainly want you to know that you are a very honored and welcome guest, and want to encourage you to read and study along with us this evening as we consider God's Word. We're going to begin this evening at 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 18 and 19. And we're trying to stay as closely as we can to the theme of calling on the name of the Lord. This evening, we're going to be talking about calling on the Lord through blood. And I want to read to you a text that, by my account, will come up two other times through the course of our study. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 18 and 19 reads as follows. For as much as you know, you were not redeemed with corruptible things, silver and gold, from the vain conversation received by tradition of your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb, without blemish, without spot. My mom used to say that God created rabbits just to feed everything else. It does seem that way, doesn't it? And I suspect he did create some things that were just, rabbits. They're basically, their only defense is to reproduce and keep having enough, and many of them get eaten. Near as I can tell from nature shows, the wildebeest serves the same purpose in Africa. Every time I'm watching a nature show and you see a wildebeest, something's fixing to eat it. It does seem like God made certain things for a particular purpose. Now, before I go any farther with the story, I'm going to tell you something that you may not be aware of, and we want to make sure we do understand this because it helps with the illustration. Because of what Jesus said about sheep and goats in Matthew 25, many people aren't aware of this. But in the Old Testament, you don't really see that distinction that is between the good and the evil, the saved and the unsaved, with sheep and goats. And what I'm talking about is in sacrifice. I know of no sacrifice in the Old Testament where it is particular to the sheep. Typically, it will be either lamb or kid, and in fact, it will often say lamb, talking about the young of both sheep and goats. So we usually think lamb, that's okay, but maybe half the time it was the goats. Now, the reason I'm telling you this is because of something that I saw happen in May of 1975, and I don't think I'll ever forget it. We had lived several places, and Dad and Mom had bought a farm in Roan County, West Virginia, while we still lived in eastern Kentucky. And being West Virginia hillbillies, I guess we always did want to get back to where we belonged. And they'd owned this farm for about a year. And church at the Marlang Church of Christ in St. Albans, they'd always kind of wanted Dad to come back, and they contacted him. Bob, why don't you come back? And Dad jokingly said, well, I would if you'd let me live on my farm. And they called his bluff. They said, okay. And so in 1973, Dad got basically all his dreams to come true at once, because preaching was his first love, followed closely by music and farming. All Dad's life, he always wanted to have a farm, and Mom did too. And we didn't have much of a house. In fact, the house we moved into didn't have indoor plumbing. We actually moved a little trailer in beside it so we'd have indoor plumbing facilities. But Mom and Dad had the time of their lives raising everything. Now, Dad always did have a garden. He'd raise a garden in town. Now he had a farm. And boy, he used it. And they just decided they were going to try out various animals. And if you name an animal, we raised it at one time or another. I mean, just about every animal you can think of, we had. Dad had 30-some ducks at once. Not on purpose, it just kind of happened. And they'd stand outside his window at the crack of dawn and quack till he came out and fed them. We had geese. But I think when I was a young fella, the thing that captured all of us more than anything else was when Mom decided she was going to buy a goat. And so we started raising goats. And they were fascinating. I was raised on goat's milk. I mean, we didn't buy hardly any milk. We milked our goats, and that's what we had. Those little goats, though, I can see Dad right now rearing back and just laughing with pure joy as he'd watch those little goats. And we had these little twin Nubian goats. And when they got to a certain age, you'd start feeding them by hand. And what you did was you went down to the southern states and they'd sell you a rubber nipple and you put it over a glass Coke bottle. You youngsters, they used to make Coke bottles out of glass. They were about this tall. But anyway, you'd shake up the formula, and then you'd hold it down, and I can see Dad now. We had a maple tree, and there was an outdoor toilet, which wasn't used for that. It was actually one of the nest areas for the chickens, and he had a lawn chair set up under that maple tree. And that was so he could go out first thing in the morning and had two of those Coke bottles and feed those two kids. And I'm telling you, if you've never been around them, they will bring a smile to your face. They'll jump up on the arm of a chair and nuzzle your ear, and they are just a joy. But what I saw this morning was quite different. It was early in May, one of those beautiful mornings where it's a little bit cool, the fog is still laying over the bottom, over the creek. And Dad was sitting in the chair, but he wasn't feeding the goat. There was one goat at his feet, dead. And Dad was holding the other goat in his arms like he'd hold a child. And I could see him now, and he was gently shaking that goat. And I could see him, he was saying, "Oh no, oh no, oh no," just like that. And I watched that for a little bit, and I had to go to school, and of course I was upset. One of the reasons I was upset is, this is a farm. And you're not really sentimental about animals on a farm. Mom would get up in the morning, shoot a chicken's head off, and then have it cut up and ready. You know, we weren't sentimental about animals at all. But there was something about those baby goats that got to your heart. And I think God does everything for a reason. And I think he did this for a reason. Turned out those two little goats had gotten into some weed killer. And, you know, he couldn't revive that goat. When I got back, you know, told us the goats, these little baby goats are dead. And we all grieved over these goats. Now, I told you that story to tell you about a grand plan. A plan that God had for you and me, a plan that God revealed in the Old Testament primarily. He revealed it, he suggested it through these little lamps. Before I get there, I have to talk to you about what the cost is here. Because what we're really talking about is the cost of sin. What does it cost? Well, the first thing I want you to understand is we're talking about real violations. We're not just talking about things that God doesn't prefer or doesn't like. We're talking about that which is real. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 4. Whosoever committeth sin transgresseth also the law, for sin is a transgression of the law. I think one of the things that John's doing there is trying to make us understand that God didn't just flip a coin over a number of human activities and then just say, well, I'm going to legislate against that one. No, I guess that one's okay. No, this one, it's not arbitrary. These are things that are actually wrong. Sometimes people will say, did God make these laws because of his own nature? That is, did he just emanate, these are the things I prefer? These are the things that are actually wrong in and of themselves. And in fact, because he is who he is, he identified those and then communicated them to mankind. Number two, when those violations take place, it creates a dividing line between men and God. Isaiah chapter 59, verses 1 and 2, the prophet says to the people, behold, the Lord's arm is not shortened that he cannot save, neither his ear heavy that he cannot hear. But your iniquities have separated between you and your God, and your sins have hid his face from you that he will not hear. So, once again, what happens because of sin? Well, because of sin, this is a real violation. Number two, it creates a distinction, not just a distinction, but a separation between mankind and God. Number three, eventually, it brings death. James chapter 1 and verse 15. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. But I still haven't even come close to explaining what the connection between that and my dad holding a dead baby goat is. For that, I need to consult Genesis chapter 9, verses 3 and 4. This is after the flood. In Genesis chapter 9, verses 3 and 4, God's speaking to Noah, and he's about to give him a great symbol for life. This is God's symbol for life. Now, there are various symbols for life. Once in a while, I would hear people say when I was growing up, older people, they'd say, I'll do this and such as long as I have breath. And I understood what that meant, and so do you. It doesn't mean if you happen to gasp for air, they're going to stop doing whatever that is. What they mean is, as long as I'm alive, this is what I'm going to do, right? So, God's ready to give mankind his great symbol for life, and he does that in the same text where he tells the human family, I authorize you to eat the animals that I've created. Genesis 9, verses 3 and 4. Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you. As the green herb have I given you all things. But flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall you not eat. Now, the reason that God gave for not consuming blood was that the blood was his symbol for life. All right, now let's think about this. If sin separates, if sin brings death, God wanted to make sure that we understood that because of our sin, something has to bleed and die. But it's what he chose to bleed and die that makes such an impression. And for this, we need to think a little bit about the history of blood, and in particular, the lamb. Going all back, the way back to virtually the beginning of time, you have in Genesis chapter 4 and verse 4, you have the example of Abel. The Bible says Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and the fat thereof, and the Lord had respect unto Abel and his offering. So here's Abel. I mean, this is generation 2 in the history of the earth. And he evidently, having been instructed from God, and I don't think that's conjecture, when we read in Hebrews chapter 11, by faith Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. If he did it by faith, it must have been by instruction, Romans 10 and verse 17, because faith comes by hearing the word of God. So at the very beginning of time, God had begun to tell the human family, because of sin, I'm demanding a particular blood sacrifice. But nowhere is this system more evident than it is by the time the law of Moses begins to be observed. And I've never bothered to count how many blood sacrifices there are, and I've never bothered to count how many of those specify the blood of the Lamb. But let's just say there are many blood sacrifices, and let's say most of those revolve around the Lamb. I'm going to tell you a few details about two of these. In Exodus chapter 12, in verse 7, we read of the institution of the original Passover. For 1,500 years, the people of God would observe this feast. And Jews today who are attempting to follow the old law will observe it as well. But the Passover takes place, well, would have been just right around this time of year. I haven't looked at a calendar, but that's about when it is. But anyway, at the Passover, if you recall, it was instituted because of the 12th plague, or the 12th, the 10th plague. The other nine plagues had been focused on an area. This is the one plague that we read about that has an action involved in order to avoid the effects of that plague. So when we get to the 10th plague, what God does is he says, on the month of Abib, which is the first Jewish month of the year, on the 14th day, you are to proceed as follows. And we'll talk about that in a moment. Now, it's also interesting that he says, on the 10th day, you are to select the lamb. I'd like for you to remember that for a moment. You select the lamb on the 10th day. He's actually offered on the 14th. Well, what do you do with the lamb? Well, the lamb's killed. In Exodus chapter 12 and verse 7, here's what it reads. And they shall take of the blood and strike it on the two side posts and the upper door posts of the houses wherein they shall eat it. All right, so we're going to take that lamb and we are going to cut its throat. And then we're going to take, it was called a hyssop. It was a plant that was a makeshift brush, like a paintbrush. And you take the blood and you paint the blood on the two side posts, the upper door post. And what was going to happen on that evening of the 10th plague, God was going to go through the land of Egypt and kill every firstborn male of all the animals and of the people. Down in verse 13, he again gives us the implications of the 10th plague. He says, and the blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where you are. And he's about to use a phrase. You may not have known where this phrase came from, but you've sung it many, many times. He says, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. That the plague shall not be upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt. Now, the procedure in the Passover, now there are many other features to the Passover, including what they were to eat, how they were to eat, even how they were to dress as they ate it. We're not going to go into all those things. But what's really interesting is in the fine print here. What happened between days 10 and 14? I remember one year we bought a pair of calves. and these were calves that were going to be butchered in the fall. And I remember my mom saying to us kids, "You will not name those calves because you can't eat something that has a name." And again, I hope you understand this is not one of those animal rights nonsense things. I really just have very, very little patience with people who don't seem to understand the difference between human beings and animals. I suppose I should have more patience with them than I do, but I really don't. A number of years ago, I was down in New Martinsville, and Jerry Yost knew this young fella had those beliefs and claimed to be a Christian, and he kind of sicked me on him, and he said he thinks it's sinful to eat meat. I said, "Where'd you get that idea?" He said, "Well, it's just wrong." I said, "You did know Jesus did." He said, "How do you know that?" I said, "Because of the Passover meal. You eat lamb with the Passover meal. It's not an option." And he looked at me, he said, "Well, if he did that, he was wrong." And at that point, I'm thinking, I'm done. I've heard people say, "I never eat anything with a face." And I say, "Me neither. I cut their little heads off first." This is not sentimentality. It had to happen. So anyway, Mom said, "You can't eat something with a name." She said, "So I'm naming the calves." She said, "That one's steak and that one's hamburger. And that's going to be their name so that we don't forget the purpose of these two calves." But you know what's going to happen if you take a lamb into your home on day 10? And you got little kids? They got 4 days with that lamb. And it doesn't matter if you say to them, "Don't get attached to that lamb." They're going to. And when the day came to take a knife and slit that poor little lamb's throat and listen to it bleat pitifully as the blood pours out of it, I kind of imagine Dad might get a little choked up too. And God said, "I want you to select it on day 10 and sacrifice it on day 14. And I think he did that for a reason. You see, it's so easy for us, with regard to our own sin, to minimize it, to excuse it, to ignore it. And I really believe God wanted people to say, "I need you to see what it does. I need you to see the blood. I need you to understand. The lamb dies so that you don't have to." Throughout the 1500 years of the history of God's people, there was another lamb that died each year, not in each household like the Passover lamb, but for the people at large. This was on the Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. In Exodus chapter 30 and verse 10, and the procedure on the Day of Atonement is quite long, quite complicated. If I remember right, there are close to 30 particular actions that take place on that day. But one thing that I'm particularly interested in is when Aaron and subsequent high priests are instructed to take the blood of the lamb and go into the most holy place, a place that could only be entered once a year, only by one person, and that was the high priest, and there to make atonement for the sins of the people. In Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 7, he references that as well, saying, "Into the second went the high priest once every year, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the errors of the people." But back here in Exodus chapter 30 and verse 10, he gives the original commandment regarding the Day of Atonement. He said, "Aaron shall make atonement upon the horns of it once a year with the blood of the sin offering of atonements. Once in the year shall he make atonement upon it. It is most holy to the Lord." So on that day, he would approach the symbolic presence of God and he would carry with him blood. And all those years, every year, the faithful people of God would be represented by the high priest who would go and, but from a human perspective, for no apparent reason, kill a lamb. In fact, they would bring to the one called, was specified as a goat, incidentally, the scapegoat. And a lot was drawn. We'd say they flipped a coin about which one became the scapegoat. And the scapegoat would be driven out of, originally out of the camp, and then once the center of worship became Jerusalem, driven out of the city. Even as Jesus suffered outside the gate. Rabbinic tradition says that as they would drive the goat out of town, they would jeer and yell and shake their fists at it as though they were causing their own sins to leave. And you might think it's a bad deal to be the scapegoat until you find out what happens to the other lamb. That's the sacrifice lamb. And he's killed. And his blood is used in all of these various places. And I have no idea how many lambs were killed in just this way. I mean, in the first century alone, the historian Josephus cites an extraordinary number of lambs that were killed during the Passover. I have no idea whether he was right or not. But it was an extraordinary number. And it happened every year. And when particular sins were committed, part of the process of being forgiven was that person would go to the priest, bring a lamb, have to watch that lamb die. And each year, you go through the Passover, you kill the lamb. And each year, you watch the high priest, only one this time for the nation, but the lamb is killed. His blood is used. And it's all this blood and all these lambs. And all of it was done with a purpose. And it turns out the purpose was Jesus. Now we go back to 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 18 and 19. And I hope that you can read this with a somewhat different flavor now. Forasmuch as you know you were not redeemed with corruptible things, such as silver and gold, from the vain conversation received by tradition of your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb, without blemish and without spot. Some of the things that God asked his people to do were difficult. I've told you one that I think probably was difficult for some people, at the very least. And so you look at this and you say, that poor little lamb, why did that lamb have to die? Never even realizing that above them, their father was saying, I'm going to send my lamb to die. It might tug at our heartstrings. It might be cute. We might have gotten a lot of joy out of those goats. But the truth is, they were nothing. God gave this as a symbol, knowing full well that he was going to watch his son die. He was going to watch him bleed. And it wouldn't be nearly as humane as the death of those little lambs. I think it must have been very, very difficult for people before the coming of Jesus, if not impossible, to understand fully the connection. Now, I've told you, as much as I'm able, about the history of blood up through the Old Testament, and then hopefully you understand how that all of this was symbolic and pointing toward Jesus. But blood makes a demand. How is it that we call in the name of God through blood? Well, let me tell you the first thing, and I really believe this is the most obvious thing. When it comes to the blood of the Old Testament, we're going to talk in particular about the blood of the Passover feast, because God was so specific. You're going to take this blood, you're going to paint the two side posts, and then you're going to paint the upper door post. The first thing you have to do with blood is apply it. Makes sense, doesn't it? Now, let me give you a hypothetical. We're going to take you back to Egypt in 1500 BC. You are now a Jewish family who's been in slavery, and God's preparing to free you from bondage, and word comes down from God's spokesman, all right, here's what's going to happen. That is God speaking through him. I'm going to kill all firstborn of Egypt, but here is the procedure by which you can protect not only your animals, but your children, your firstborn son, the firstborn male. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but you know, all the firstborn males of every family in here, if you're the firstborn male and you don't do this, you're done. You're gone. You're dead tonight. All you have to do is follow the procedure that I'm about to give you. Now imagine that you, if you're a man, that you are the head of the Jewish household, you get that word, and you settle into your recliner, not that they had them there, but it's important for the picture I'm about to paint. You settle into your recliner, you pull the lever, you bring up the seat, and you say, that's great news. I believe that. I believe God's going to save us by his grace. Does that make any sense to anybody? Your wife's standing there saying, you're going to what? I believe it would be an insult to God for me to insist that we have to obey him in this matter, because God saves us by grace and I believe his word. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. I think it's nearly unanimous. Every wife in here would agree the thing to do at that point is grab him by the ear, pull him up out of there and say, have you lost your mind? Get out there and do what God said. And the religious world tonight is full of people. Literally full. I'm telling you, most of the religions I'm familiar with will tell you that when the Bible tells us how to apply the blood, we don't have to do that. Let's look again at Romans 6, verses 3 and 4 that we studied for a moment last night. And let's see if it verifies this. Let's see if it shows us, here's how to apply the blood, or apply the death is the wording it uses, but to seek and find the power of the death of Christ. No, you're not. That so many of us, as we're baptized into Jesus Christ, we're baptized into his what? Into his death. Therefore, we are buried with him by baptism into death. That like as Christ was raised up from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. Right there he tells you the way to access the power of the death of Christ. That's not my interpretation. It's exactly what Paul said. Can you prove that? Yep. No, you're not. That so many of us, how many of us? So many of us, or all of us? So many of us as have been baptized into Jesus Christ were what? Baptized into his death. Logic dictates and logic demands that those who have not done that have not touched the power of the death of Christ. And most of the religions I know will tell you straight-faced, oh, no, you don't have to obey God. All you have to do is believe. Okay, I'll get back in my easy chair and say, all I have to do is believe God's going to save me. And isn't it strange how we can understand conditions when it comes to our lives and we can't understand them when it comes to our souls? We pay more attention to our car mechanic than we do to the Bible. Isn't that a simple thing when he says, here's the procedure for saving your son's life? Why not do it? Isn't that simple when he says, here's the procedure for applying the blood of Christ? Why not do it? Now somebody says, well, that's just an action. Being baptized into Christ, just an action, that's just a ritual. Demand number two. It has to be done in faith. Now, if you were to ask me in the Old Testament in Egypt, if somebody could just have serious doubts and maybe not even believe God, but because his wife made him apply the blood, would that work? I really don't know. I have an opinion. I'm not even going to share it because it doesn't make any difference. Here's what I know about New Testament blood applying. It does make a difference what you think about it. How do you know that? Let's go to Romans chapter 3 and verse 25. With regard to Jesus, it reads, whom God set forth to be a propitiation, which is a big fancy word that's talking about a sacrifice, but whom God set forth to be a propitiation through faith in his blood. So I can't just apply the blood and not think that it actually is doing anything. I actually have to have conviction in what I'm doing in the New Testament. It might have worked to put the blood on, not really believe it in the Old Testament. I know, based on Romans chapter 3 and verse 25, that the application of the blood has to include my conviction. Whom God set forth to be a propitiation through faith in his blood to declare his righteousness for the remission of sins that are past through the forbearance of God, which is all about forgiveness. About 1970, we were living, Dad was preaching in Waynesboro, Georgia. It was a very small place, a small congregation. It was a mission work. And there was a fellow there, and you know, just about every church I've ever known has somebody just like Joe. Joe was at every service. I mean, he never missed a service. And you could just count on Joe being there. Joe was a decent fellow who lived a life just pretty much like you would expect a good, faithful Christian to live. There's just one problem with Joe. He wasn't a Christian. And I remember this. I was only, well, if it was 70, I was you know, 6 going on 7. But there were two men who were at services this Sunday evening. And these men were both confined to a wheelchair. And one of them was a pretty big fella. But they came forward at the invitation. They wanted to be baptized. Wanted to put on Christ in baptism. Well, here's the problem. Dad looked around, and it's a Sunday evening. There's a few people missing, and they're going to have to carry this man down the baptistry steps to get him in and baptize him. Well, the only able-bodied man besides him was Joe. And Joe got up into the baptistry with Dad, and he helped him. He helped him carry the wheelchair down into the baptistry, and Dad was able to baptize him. Of course, you know, the water helped some so far as reducing the weight and everything, but Joe got down into the baptistry with Dad and literally helped him baptize somebody. And after services, somebody said, Bob, you should have grabbed Joe and baptized him while you had him there. How many of you think that'd do Joe any good? You know, if that's all it was, we would identify tonight those who needed to obey the gospel. We got enough people here. We can swarm you, tackle you, hog tie you, and put you under. Won't do you a bit of good. A few years ago at West Virginia Christian Youth Camp, I think this is the only time I've ever baptized somebody while laughing so hard I couldn't get my breath. And that sounds terrible, but I'm going to tell you how it happened. We had a young fella, he was about 13, he wanted to be baptized into Christ. And intermediate week, we usually tried to downplay that a little bit just because emotions are running high and we love when people obey the gospel, but we wanted to make sure that these were legitimate and not just fueled by emotion. But anyway, one of my staff members came to me and said, this young man wants to be baptized. I said, all right, let's talk to him, make sure that he knows what he's doing. We talked to him. We were convinced he did. And I said, all right, I want you to take care of this. And so he went to baptize the boy, and about 10 minutes later, he came back, and he said, I can't. I said, what do you mean you can't? He said, he's afraid of water. I can't get him under. It was like trying to baptize a cat. And every time you try to take him down, here come an arm, here come another, here the leg. Something was always out. And the boy, I sure hope he's not here tonight, but the boy, I remember this because his voice hadn't changed yet. And I said, I don't remember his name either. I said, now you're sure this is what you want to happen? And it's just because you're afraid of the water, right? Uh-huh. I said, okay, we're going to make it happen this time. So I got helpers, and I chose helpers based purely on size. And I got four of the biggest guys I had on staff and said, you got this arm, you got this arm, you got this leg, you got this leg. And I said, all right, I'm going to do this, and you guys are going to help me. And so we basically had him confined where he couldn't move. And the part where I was laughing, when I actually put him under, again, it was just the fear of water. He was going, no, no. Only it sounded like this. It went, no, no. So the point is, I guess you can force somebody under the water. If we have enough people, we can force them under the water. And we did then, but it was because ultimately that's what he wanted to happen. But that won't do you any good without faith. And the third demand is that we live as though we have been through the blood. That's one of the big problems in the Old Testament that I've seen. One of the great delusions of God's Old Testament people was that they thought that because they were God's people, it didn't matter how they lived. And my, oh my, didn't they suffer the consequences for it? In 1 John chapter 1 and verse 7, John reminds us, if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship one with another, and the blood of Jesus Christ, his Son, cleanseth us from all sin. And I'm just about ready to finish up this lesson. There's only one brief section I want to leave with you, and that is the blessings that God provides because of blood. And when we call on his name through blood, number one, who's it for? Well, it's for everybody. Hebrews chapter 2:9 reads, but we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste of death for every man. You know, Calvinism says Jesus only died for the saved. I've always wondered how it's possible to reach that conclusion when the Hebrews writer speaks so clearly. But more to the point, you do understand that means he died for you. And it doesn't matter who you are, he died for you. What happens? Well, a couple of nights we've made reference to Acts chapter 22, verse 16. I want to do that again. Paul was told this, now why are you waiting? Arise and be baptized and wash away thy sins, calling on the name of the Lord. You know, as I return for the last time to that text in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verses 18 and 19, I want to show you something else in that verse that I think is important. You might want to read it again as well. And notice that it reads, for as much as you know, you were not redeemed. Redeemed. And if you ever listen to preachers preach on this, they'll usually define this and define it correctly as buying back. That's what it means to redeem, to buy something back. And I've often heard somebody illustrate it by talking about the procedure at a pawn shop. If you bring something in, you pawn it off, you can redeem that something, which means you go and buy it back with an interest penalty. But I don't think Peter was talking about pawning anything. I don't even know if that concept existed, but pretty sure that's not what he was talking about. I've never pawned anything myself. I've bought several things from pawn shops, but I've never actually pawned anything. But I'm reasonably certain about this, that the things, the items that are for sale in a pawn shop, not one of them pawned themselves. I think something else was on Peter's mind when he wrote that, and I suspect something else was on the mind of the people who read it. Because there was something else at the time that got redeemed. It was people, slaves. The Roman world was full of slaves. It's been estimated there were more slaves than free men in the Roman Empire. And often, the way one would become a slave would be, quite frankly, he would sell himself into slavery. And there was a procedure for being released from slavery, which included paying a certain price that was his worth in order to obtain his freedom. The problem is this: if you didn't have the money to get yourself out of that situation to begin with, you probably don't have the means to obtain it at any point in the future. And if you don't have any friends or family to be able to keep you from that condition, you're probably not going to have that once you're in slavery, so you're probably stuck there. But along comes Jesus. And Jesus says, I'll pay the price for his freedom. And he's going to do that even though I sold myself into it. He comes along, he says, I will pay the price for your freedom. How much? Your blood. That's the price. I'll pay it. For as much as you know, you were not redeemed with corruptible things such as silver and gold from the vain conversation received by tradition of your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. Tonight, if you're not a child of God, we're going to sing a song of invitation to invite you to apply the blood and to call in the name of Christ. If this evening you're not a Christian, Jesus said, he that believes that is baptized shall be saved. Maybe you're thinking, well, I'm a Christian, but that's not exactly how I became one. Well, then you became a Christian on your terms, not on those of God. And that won't work. Why not apply the blood? Why not do it the way that the Lord commanded? Why not this evening? Why not this evening make a change in your life, be pleasing to God? Why not leave this place having been cleansed, having called on the name of the Lord? Why not come to Jesus this evening? Will you come as we stand and sing?